real skin results start with one daily ritual. Meet Daily Microfoliant from Dermalogica. This iconic exfoliating powder activates with water to gently polish away dullness and uneven texture. It leaves skin instantly smoother and more luminous while supporting your skin barrier. Formulated with professional expertise to deliver visible results daily, even on sensitive skin. Discover your healthiest skin today. Visit Dermalogica.com and use code SMOOTH at checkout for an exclusive gift with your $65 purchase.
Testing season is right around the corner, and this is when confidence really matters. When kids take time to review key concepts and strengthen their skills before assessments, it can make all the difference. IXL helps reinforce what they're learning right now, so they walk into every test feeling prepared, capable, and confident. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts. Designed for students from pre-K through 12th grade, IXL delivers personalized, interactive practice that adapts to your child's level and pace. It's an easy, effective way to support learning as the school year heads into its final stretch. Studies show kids who use IXL score higher on tests, proven in all 50 states. IXL is used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now, and listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLLearning.com/audio. Visit IXLLearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Why have I asked my HVAC guy I found on Angie.com to change my grandpa's trachea tube? Because I was so amazed by how quickly he replaced our air ducts. I knew I could trust him to change Pop-Pop's tube while I was on vacation.
Make it quick, young man.
Aw, see? Pop-Pop trusts you.
I think we should call a doctor.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
Welcome to Synapse, Think Tank of the Air, featuring influencers, creatives, and thought leaders in the Twin Cities. And now, here is our host, Steve Lebeau.
And I'm Steve Lebeau. Welcome to Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. And here we're going to have, well, I used to host a show, co-host a show, Lunch with the Governor. So now it's kind of be Lunch with the Synapse folks. We have several foodies here to share our meal. And we have MJ Kinney, who's with Farm Science, or Fair Science.
That's correct. Fair as in F-A-R-E.
Fair. Everything with food is farm to something, so it's farm,
you know,
to farm
I
to
might
science.
Somehow incorporate that in my slogan in the future.
Okay. So MJ is a scientist, a food scientist, and we have Kim Lee Curry, who is known to a lot of people, at least visually. At least your food is visually known to them. Hello.
Hi, how are you? Sorry.
Also known as Little Miss Foodie. And we have also Jeremy Iggers, a person I've known for a long time. He's the former food critic for the Star Tribune for how many years was that, Jeremy?
22 plus.
Wow.
How many meals did you have on their tab?
Oh, let's see. That would probably work out to somewhere around 3,000. No, more than that. More like 5 or 6,000.
Five or 6,000. Boy, and they all blend.
I missed that expense account, I tell you.
It all blends into one big buffet.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, we're having food as we sit. Thanks to K Viet Cafe, or restaurant in Northeast Minneapolis?
It's in Northeast Minneapolis on Johnson Street.
Okay, they somehow bestowed upon you all this food. Do you want to describe what we're eating or would be eating if we weren't on the mics?
Oh, sure. I brought some egg rolls here from them. They're known for their famous egg rolls. They've been around, I think, since 1980.
Those are giant egg rolls.
They are.
And they're also, they've got this puffy exterior, which is really makes egg rolls wonderful, and most places don't seem to know how to do it, but they nailed this one.
You're
it's
right
like a
that.
Donut. It's like
it
a
is,
long
it looks
john.
Like it, and they're huge. Mm-hmm. And they're also at the state fair, too. The egg roll on a stick.
I think that's what theirs?
Yeah, that's theirs. Same family.
Okay.
And then this one is a grilled pork vermicelli rice salad.
Okay.
And here it looks like a hot and spicy chicken and shaken beef, and then a tofu grilled or tofu salad, too, noodle salad.
Well, is that kind of a token vegan deal?
It is.
Okay.
Gluten-free and vegan deal, right?
Yes, gluten-free and vegan.
Oh, gluten-free.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so everyone can eat. Well, I'll start. For each of you, I'd like to know, what was the thing that made you a foodie? What turned you into a person that focused on the career that you did focus on? We'll start with MJ, since you don't have anything in your mouth yet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I
That means
chose,
the other two of you can eat
you
for
can
a while.
You can totally eat. Oh, yeah, really? Please bite into that egg roll, because if I could, I would.
Oh, yeah, there's some eating.
Yeah. There. You should probably bite into it, like, right into the mic, so everyone can hear how crunchy it is.
I heard that. We recorded that for posterity.
Yeah, ooh. It looks amazing.
These are good.
So I chose food science, and how I found food science was really just kind of a miracle. It was a very deep Google search. I knew that...
You Google searched your career?
Oh, yeah, I Google searched it, absolutely. Because
wow, what am I going to be when I grow up, Google?
I just knew I needed to be somewhere in the food industry, and I didn't know like what that position looked like. And I knew I was interested in health and wellness. And so the most immediate things that popped into my mind were dietetics. So, you know, becoming a registered dietitian.
Oh, sure.
Maybe working in a school or a hospital setting.
Saying, don't eat that.
Right. And then I just thought, and I could have a totally wrong interpretation of this career, but I just thought that would really cater to one part of society, a given population. And I really wanted to get in on the ground floor of what food is and where it comes from. And I thought the best way to do that was in a career in food science and really in product development. So to create the food products that make it onto the store shelves was really what captivated me when I found food science.
I'm trying to get over the metaphor on the ground floor of food.
Yeah, I mean, so. Food science can be in so many shapes and forms, and the shape and form that I chose was product development. Mm-hmm. So when I say product development in food, that can be a bit on the innovation side. Hopefully it is. A lot of people who want a career in science want to be a part of something that's new and changing and progressive.
So food, I bet they have those over at Cargill and General Mills.
Absolutely. Alongside product development, you can also have somebody who's in a quality assurance or a food safety role, which is so critical to...
Food tasters.
Yeah. I mean, taste testers, sensory would be the field in food science. So it's establishing...
You could be a food sensor?
Sensory scientist, but I think sensor kind of sounds nice. Yeah, you could go into a
unless it depends on if you spell it with an S or a C.
Yeah, so there are so many career options with food science. In making my parents happy, I just said I'm going to choose this thing called food science, and you'll like it because it'll give me the most options for a job after college.
Wow.
And you know, I'll never starve. Well, when I'm surrounded by food.
I went to a science fair when my daughter was in grade school, and one of the other students had a project on chemistry and food, mm-hmm. and they baked different chocolate chip cookies, and this one you added extra flour, and this one you took out the sugar, and they had all these experiments on how you could go wrong so you can recognize your mistakes. But mm-hmm. it's amazing the chemical differences that each ingredient makes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you learn about that?
Oh, for sure. And relating that to what the consumer sees, and also to answer any questions of, like, what is considered healthy food, really take a look at a nutrition facts panel, and it can tell you a lot. So when you look at a nutrition facts panel, there are three macronutrients, and those are fats, carbohydrates, and proteins. And essentially, any product, it's a certain ratio of those macronutrients that create the taste, the texture that you like, as well as the nutritional, you know, content of that product.
Well, I bet you're the kind of person, you go to a ball game, you're looking at the box scores and all the facts and figures, and then...
That's really
oh, there's a
nice
game
thought.
Going on, but look at all these
sports.
Numbers. And let's see, let's pick on some of the people that are busy eating here. Let's see, Kim Lee, are
yes.
you enjoying your Vietnamese food?
I'm loving it, actually. It's my first meal today. I haven't had much today.
Oh, okay. So this is your breakfast?
This is my breakfast and lunch for now.
Well, good. Now, tell me, how did you become a big foodie? I understand that you have an Instagram account that gets like 40,000 followers. You are the influencer, food influencer of Minnesota, and maybe, who knows, North Dakota.
Yeah, I got interested in food. I've always loved food. Even as a kid, my parents nicknamed me... Kim Hale means pig, piggy, because as a little kid, I was always wanting and eating food, too. And I'm always, like, I guess I'm obsessed with food. Like, I can't stop thinking about it, eating it, looking at pictures of food, reading about, I mean, it can be anything. Like you're talking about, like, your whole job description, food scientist. That is so fascinating to me.
I love to hear that, because for so long, I just thought, nobody's going to be interested in this field. And then slowly, I was like, oh, if only I could figure out a way to help them better understand this field. So I really appreciate that you're interested.
Oh, I want to talk more about
yeah.
it.
And
yeah,
and this is how you know someone's found the right job,
I think
too.
You just converted someone to be a scientist.
I know.
I'm so happy.
So then...
And so you always liked it, and then what caught on? What made you big?
I discovered Instagram in 2013 when I saw pictures of food, people posting food, and I go, oh my goodness, I want to do that just for fun because it's something it's like an outlet for me. And so I just started taking pictures of food, posting it, and never knew it would go anywhere. So
what made it hit big?
I think it hit big when, is it 2014 maybe? Fire Lake reached out to me, and they were the first one to invite me to go to their restaurant in exchange for taking pictures and posting it and talking about it. They would offer me food, comp food.
We'll post for food.
Oh, gosh. I like that. You're really good with
what slogans. A career path. Right to the restaurant door. And Jeremy, how did you become a food critic? Were you just, because people don't always know, you have a PhD in philosophy, which doesn't qualify you for anything.
It doesn't. Well, when I was 19, I decided to hitchhike around the world. Or actually, I went part of the way in a VW camper, the way a lot of people did in those days. And what I discovered is in places like Turkey, where we didn't speak a word of the language and hardly anybody spoke any English, the one connecting point for making a contact with the local community and the culture was the local restaurant. You'd walk into a cafe and smile, and they'd smile, and there'd be a bunch of pots, and they would lift the lid off the pot, and you'd look at it and nod your head, and they'd nod their heads. And it was like the entry point into another world. And so when I got back to Minnesota, I decided I want to keep doing that. And I couldn't afford to keep traveling like that. So I discovered that going to little ethnic restaurants was a way of sort of recreating that experience. And it's still true to this day. One of the best places to get entry into the Somali community is to go into a Somali restaurant or the I guess there are a few Hmong restaurants come and go, but it's, again, you go into the restaurant, you order something, you can get into a conversation, and it's, for me, it's more the anthropology, the exploring of other cultures that attracted me to it.
So it's the entree to a culture.
Yeah. And that's especially true, as I say, it's still very true in the Twin Cities. Hmm.
Well, I think it's kind of vice versa, too, because for a lot of the immigrant groups, at first, the railroad recruited a lot of Chinese people to come and work on the railroad back in the 19th century, before the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. And then they'd work on the railroad, and then you'd be done with that section. So there they are in the middle of nowhere, so they would start a Chinese restaurant. That's why they're in a lot of little small towns. And so then, just to continue that story, in 1882, no more Chinese could come in. So then the railroad people said, hey, let's get the Japanese. They're different, and no one will know. And so then you started getting a lot of Japanese immigrants, and then they did the same thing. So that's how we got Japanese restaurants. And that kind of goes on. A lot of new people come in. What do they have is their food to share. It's kind of a big circle of life, circle of food.
It is. And I'm still doing it, I don't know how many years after I started. I now have this website called globaltwincities.com where I seek out cultural events in all the different communities that make up the Twin Cities, and especially food events when I can find them.
Hmm. Do you go to the Festival of Nations at the food court?
I haven't gone to that one recently. It's I know it's an old tradition, and
it's like a starter place. Yeah. If you don't know where to go, get a lot of samples. We're talking here about food and eating food. It smells so good. I haven't had a bite yet. How does it taste, Kim?
I think it's really good.
So any comments? Is it spicy? Is it non-spicy?
Oh, it's not spicy yet. I've only had the grilled pork vermicelli salad, but I'm going to work on going to I think this is the shaken beef. I don't know what the shaken beef is yet, so I'll try that.
We'll work our way through as we continue through the program. And MJ, did you find something? I understand.
I did find something. I'm so happy. There's like at the bottom of this noodle bowl, which is like, I'm assuming like rice noodles. There's firm tofu on top. And I've really had a hard time finding tofu that I can really like.
Really?
It's. I mean, when you take tofu home, it's like, how do you prepare this? Is it supposed to taste so bland? So this is very flavorful. And then at the bottom are all the veggies. So it's like, it's like a little treat.
Oh, I'm glad. I didn't see that too right away.
There's some bean sprouts and lettuce in there. So no, I totally found something. And which is hard for me as someone who's gluten-free and trying to eat mainly a plant-based diet.
Gluten-free. When did you discover that?
That was 10 years ago, maybe a little longer. It was before it was popular. It was before there were really any options out there on the grocery store shelves. And so when gluten-free happened to me, it was just an understanding that all the things that I relied upon and that I really enjoyed eating were out of the equation. So that included things like bread and cereal and pizza.
So no more.
No, just no more. Yeah. But I mean, now when I eat gluten-free bread, I'm so grateful. Like, and you know, there's an individual here in the Twin Cities who does gluten-free vegan donuts. That was the first time in my life I've had a gluten-free glazed and vegan donut. Like, it makes people cry, because when you've been there for 10 years and you're like, I just can no longer eat this, and you know you still crave those foods if you're being real with yourself, it means a lot to have that option available.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. So good for you. And you're gluten-free because of health reasons. I mean, you'll have a reaction if you eat
gluten.
Yeah,
basically every unattractive thing. Like, you don't want to be near me after I eat gluten.
But the vegan part, that's optional.
That is optional. And the reason why, and I don't identify with veganism, I think that there is a lot to veganism that is admirable and respectable. But that word over time, and maybe it's because whenever anybody enters the market and they say something that's different, it's viewed as radical. But it turns a lot of people off, and I don't want plant-based nutrition to turn anybody off.
Plant-based nutrition.
Yes. So when I say plant-based, I mean mainly plant-based diet. So it could incorporate some animal byproducts, and I'm actually not a vegan individual. I consume a lot of eggs, and I wish I had another option available to me. So fortunately, there are companies in this world that are working on that, like, well, formerly Hampton Creek, but now Just. So they have a product called Scrambled, which I'm waiting to hit grocery store shelves here in the Twin Cities that I can buy. But essentially, they've created a liquid egg that you could buy in a carton, to my understanding, and it cooks just like an omelet, like real eggs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've heard that. There's some like restaurants that serve vegan, you know, that are vegan restaurants. I've read that they've mimicked that.
Oh.
Did you say it's called Just?
It's called Just, yeah.
Mm. Mm.
Yep,
Just. Interesting.
J-U-S-T. I think they got into a little bit of trouble with Jaden Smith's Just Water, which is...
Oh!
Yeah, but the whole concept and philosophy behind Just is something that I share and resonate with, because once you understand the capability of plants, it's almost a greater sin for me to not abide by a plant-based diet, because I see everything that they could accomplish.
Well, you know, I'd like to dig into the you dig into molecules and you go into atoms and all those things. But if you dig into the DNA, I understand that plants share some DNA with us. I mean, we're all from the same original life form, as far as I can tell. And I've looked into it really deeply. But I used to be a vegetarian on the basis of it was a sin to kill animals, but plants are okay. And now I think it's a sin to kill plants too. So yeah. I kind of, you know, what are you going to do? You may as well, if you're a sinner, may as well sin broadly. And yeah. So,
I hear you.
But don't you have you're a scientist. Don't you, what do you think about the DNA in plants that we share?
You know, I can't speak too much strength on the DNA of plants and how it relates to human DNA. But something interesting about plants is when you try to understand how plants can deliver on a nutritional story that's equivalent to or better than animal-based products, you start to realize that plants actually feed the animals that you eat. So the animals deem this as nutrition that's worthy for their bodies, that's effective for their bodies. And when it comes down to the building blocks of what a protein is, whether it's a plant-based protein or an animal-based protein, you're talking about a diversity of amino acids.
Hmm.
There are plants out there that deliver on the same amino acid profile as animal-based products.
Hmm. Now, I've talked to a physician friend who says it's okay, you can still get those amino acids, but you really have to work at it to get the broad amount of nutrition and protein and things that you get from an animal's, to try to get all that from a plant-based.
I may have agreed with her maybe a few years ago, but that is changing and so quickly. And
he told me this a few years ago. Maybe it's obsolete.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, when people buy a protein bar, and myself included, before I became, you know, in this industry and was getting the hands-on experience, how do they get 20 grams of plant-based protein to fit into a bar? How is that even possible? If I were to try to make this at home, do I grind up a bunch of peas and, you know, compact it into a mold?
Right.
And the reason why that is possible today is because there is a true level of innovation in the process that makes those plant proteins taste as good as they are and have the nutritional profile they do. So that's possible due to, like, pea protein isolates or isolates that are derived and concentrates that are derived from any plant-based protein source. So fava bean, for instance, chickpea is really popular. And essentially what you do is you take this ingredient from farms, you create it into a homogeneous material, and then in manufacturing, you isolate out those macronutrients you were previously talking about.
Hmm.
So if a you know, a yellow field pea, for instance, has like a 65 to 75% starch content, which is carbohydrates, and, you know, a 20 to 25% protein content, very little fat, then how do we separate out those macronutrients so that we can have more protein per serving and serving on a weight basis?
It sounds like there's also not only a science part to food, but also the artistic side to food, both the art of how you manufacture those things so that it tastes good. And then more importantly, I think, to Kim, how it looks when you can photograph it.
That's true.
So do you, are there things, has there been a food so ugly you would not photograph it?
I'll take pictures of it, but I might not necessarily post it.
Okay, you have some standards, artistic standards.
I do. I kind of do. Because if you're going to promote a restaurant, you kind of want the food to stand out too, mm-hmm. besides mm-hmm. being really good, but it should somewhat look good too. I mean, it doesn't have to, but for me, it does.
Okay, we're going to take a break now and photograph this food before it disappears. We're on the Synapse Think Tank of the Air with MJ Kinney, food scientist, Kim Lee Curry, food photographer, and Jeremy Eggers, a food lover from way back.
Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back with our food break here. We're back to the eating food right on our middle of our podcast. Steve LeBeau here talking with a bunch of foodies. We have MJ Kinney from Fair Science, Kim Lee Curry, also known as Little Miss Foodie, and Jeremy Eggers. I don't know what your nickname is.
Frank, Igor.
Okay, he'll go by anything. Just give him the food. So, talking about the value of food, there's a cultural element, and it's also the way people get together and share food. I mean, that's the whole idea of, mentioned the meaning of company is with bread, and bread is, you know, broadened out to mean food. So your companions, you always want to share food. That's kind of the highlight of good etiquette or good hospitality. It's the way people get together in foreign countries. In Japan, what they do is they have little plastic figurines of the food so you can see what it's going to look like. You can't eat it, but it looks so good. Otherwise, how do you go around finding what food is that you like, Jeremy, when you see something that you've never seen before?
Order it and try it. I mean, often by now, you know, between Yelp and Instagram and the restaurant's websites, you can, you know, you look at the gallery, you get a pretty good idea of what you're going to get before you get there. For me, it's really more interesting to try something where I don't know exactly what to expect or what it's going to look like.
Would you rather not know what's in it?
I think for the most part, I'd rather know what's in it. Or or at least I'd rather you lie to me if certain things are in it, you know.
Because that can make a difference. Does that happen to you, Kim?
Yeah, I'd like to know what's in the food, too. Because on my Instagram, I always describe what the food, you know, like what's in the food, so people know if like there's like a certain allergy or something they don't like. Or otherwise, for me, when I research food, I just, like what Jeremy says, I just go in and just order sometimes. You know, I look to see what people have too, but I like to just go in blindly if I can too and try something out.
I was at a party once by a fellow from Thailand who was in the theater world, and he surprised everybody with his dinner, and so the food had like frog legs in it, and there were chicken feet, and all those, you know, tripe, things like that. And I've seen people just get sick looking at them, not even eating it. So there's a lot of food that's in your head before it even gets to your tongue.
Where was this event?
Well, this was at a guy's house who was a theater director.
Mm-hmm.
So he just, that was his sense of humor, expressing, let's see how these people react to this odd food.
Right.
And
how cool. Well, that's
how
an anti-food waste story.
Well, it's as soon as people realized what was happening, they got very picky.
Oh, I'm
very
sure
picky.
Did.
I mean,
anybody eat any of the actual products?
Well, I tried to eat a chicken foot, but, you know, it's kind of hard. I mean, I don't...
There's a texture to that, too, and you're not used to it. So then you're like, what is this?
Mm-hmm. Right. And, well, I think every culture has something that other cultures find odd, and then the native people love it. You just got to have this, and then they push it for you, and it's like, oh, well, wait a second. But have you traveled a lot, Kim? Have you seen other countries?
Not as much. No, I've just stayed in the States more.
Seen lots of restaurants.
Lots of restaurants. I do like to try different foods, though. One of the few things I'm not a huge fan of are, like, mushrooms.
Breaks my heart.
That's a food-based plant.
It is, but, I mean, I'll eat vegetarian burgers.
Plant-based food.
You know, I know it's mixed in, mm-hmm. but if I don't, I guess if I can't see it, if it's not like, I guess maybe when I say mushrooms, I'm thinking raw, like mushrooms in a can.
Yeah.
That kind of grosses me out. It's like kind of slimy to me, and it's kind of mm-hmm. weird. Otherwise, the only mushroom I really like are like truffles.
Interesting. So she likes the expensive kind of mushrooms.
Right. Well, then you have a good taste.
Yeah.
Jeremy, is there anything you won't eat?
Kidneys, liver. About every 5 years, somebody tries to convince me that you've just never had liver done right before. You know, and so I get conned into it, and I order liver, and then, yeah, no, this is what I hated about it the last time.
So now, to me, liver, I agree with you on liver, but it's kind of on a continuum with escargot, because I think escargot, that's like one big liver.
Nah, it's chewy, and plus there's usually a lot of garlic with it.
Okay.
No, I like escargot. I even like tripe, but... Liver and kidneys have kind of a strong flavor that I just don't like.
What about you, MJ? You've already cut out a lot of things.
I like kidney beans.
Kidney beans. There you go.
You know, I have cut out a lot of food products, and it's really interesting. As you're talking, I'm thinking about things like food bringing people together. When you try to establish a new diet that's right for you, whether it's for health or nutritional reasons or just out of, you know, philosophical reasons, you can create a divide between people. So I try never to approach anyone's diet with a level of judgment. I don't think it's fair to judge somebody by what they eat. But when you're really close to the subject matter, like you're a food scientist, you're aware than most of the population of what it takes to create that food product. So do you decide to do something about it that's going to be in a direction that's progressive or stay the same or, you know, I don't know.
Kind of like meat yeah. products now, not just meat, but what is it, like beyond meat?
Yeah, so I eat a lot of plant-based meat products, which would be,
quote marks on the meat.
Well, I say, so beyond meat's really what like got me thinking about meat in a whole different way, because I picked up a product, and at this time they had these chicken strips that were available in the produce section. They no longer are able to make that product. I think they're filling a large demand in their frozen department, but this product, I was like, beyond meat. And so I was thinking, what actually is meat? And then how can you make meat better, as in go beyond what traditional meat is. And so much of food science is understanding what you're talking about, I would say maybe with any industry. So we have terminology and we have definitions for things. There are standards of identity for the food that we eat, and rightfully so. But when you're looking at meat, is it that it contains a certain amount of protein per serving? Is that what the consumer thinks meat is? And does it have to come from an animal in the traditional or more realistically factory farming sense, or could it be
the test tube
grown?
Yeah. Test tube meat.
So with test tube meat, I want to make sure that the consumer understands that a lot of product development happens initially in a lab environment. And then also, what is a lab and what is a kitchen? There are a few things that separate them.
Oh, I never thought of that one.
I mean, because I
experiment in my kitchen.
I experiment in my kitchen, and my kitchen is really set up so that as an independent consultant for the field of food science and specifically with plant proteins, that I can do a lot of my work from home. So maybe I have some equipment that's out of the ordinary for a standard kitchen, but
I can look
it's still
up,
considered my kitchen before it's considered a lab. Yeah.
Bunsen
burners.
That sounds
awesome, actually.
Yeah. It's not that fancy at all. Like,
now, do you cook?
I am a pretty lazy cook. I meal prep. So I buy things pretty much prepared, and I mix them together. So what I mean by that is a lot of produce, I love that it comes washed and ready in a bag, ready to go. I eat a lot of produce in comparison to anything else that would be like plant-based, or I mean, excuse me, like animal-based. I eat a lot of eggs still, and I would like to cut back on that just if I could support a plant-based protein as an alternative. And I eat a lot of Beyond Meat products. So primarily their chicken strips, which are in the frozen section, their beef crumbles, and then their hamburger patties, which you can find right next to your regular meat products in your Whole Foods or your produce section as well.
Well, Kim, are these fake meats photogenic? Is the real stuff?
You can make them photogenic.
Yeah.
Because they look pretty similar to the real deal, actually. Like the strips you're talking about, they look really good.
Yeah, so much of what Kim does is actually so important to food scientists, because if you're developing a food product, you're trying to reduce that barrier between you and the consumer who's buying your product. And that barrier will be reduced when you can make it look pretty.
Look pretty and taste good.
Yeah,
too.
And taste good.
I mean, that's important too.
And good for you.
And if you can convert some people that, you know, there's some people who will not eat it because they're like, well, it's fake meat, so why don't you just eat real meat? It's like that whole, you know, conversation.
And then me, I'm like, but what is meat? And then they're like, well... And when you try to put a technical definition around it, it starts getting hard. But if meat for you is a way to get protein into your body that tastes similar to what the meat was that you were raised on, there's no reason why that can't be derived from plants if it's actually delivering on that.
And it's healthier, too.
Well, to go back to the cultural sense, I mean, a lot of foods are what you inherited from your parents. And so to have a steak or a hamburger or whatever, it's not so much... Hey, it's time for protein. It's like, well, let's have a steak to celebrate someone just had a victory, or let's go out for hamburgers because it's fun. Everybody likes those, except for the vegans, and they can have a soy burger.
I love hamburgers. Oh, you do? I miss steak. I really do. I mean,
there's some fake ones out there now.
Which ones are you?
Brother and sister.
They're a Bivers Butcher that are here. Oh. Yeah, actually, they're...
Their ribeye is really good.
Yeah.
Their ribeye is really good. Their cheese is really good, too.
Yeah.
I really like them.
A lot of people really like their products. I haven't actually been into their store yet. I know that they don't have any gluten-free options available yet. So to make their product what it is, they rely on vital wheat gluten for their meat analogs, as we would call them. But... when I say the word analog, I know that could be a scary science term. It really just means to make something
like... as opposed to digital.
To make something like the traditional version.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Jeremy, did you ever go to one of those restaurants that was serving these pseudo meats and things and review them?
Yeah, now I'm trying to remember where it was. Maybe in Toronto. There was a... until recently, the Evergreen on Nicollet, which I think closed very recently, they had a big selection of mock meats, including some that really were pretty sophisticated.
Mm.
They'd have mock barbecue pork with little slivers of red and white and what looked fatty and what looked... And those were really good. I mean, they didn't really fool anybody in terms of actually thinking this was beef or chicken, but they were respectably close. And I don't know, I think people sometimes think of this as being really sort of high-tech chemistry stuff. Back in the 80s, when I was a food writer for the Detroit Free Press, our kitchen writer and I got together. Well, she did most of the work, actually. But we made veal scallopini out of gluten, and it was a really simple process. You take a bunch of flour, you kind of rinse it in water, and eventually all the starch washes away, and you're left with gluten. I guess you couldn't eat this, MJ, but it was...
you took the starch.
We breaded it, fried it up like schnitzel, and brought it to the features editor, who was fooled by it. He was really kind of annoyed afterwards.
But he couldn't tell the difference between that and
veal scallopini. So, and it's not like it involves, you know, super high-tech chemistry or anything. It was pretty simple.
Yeah.
I think it's hard to make really, like, good vegan meat and food, too, to taste good. It's like more work into it than regular food. You know what I mean? To get creative, you have to be creative. I feel like you have to be more creative with it to get people to eat it too.
I do agree with you to an extent, because when I got into this industry, I thought the same thing, and I actually wasn't interested in really creating any kind of a vegan analog. But then I was thinking, if I was raised on recipes, like my mother cooked when I was growing up, and I was raised on recipes or had an instruction on how to, just like how she taught me how to prepare chicken, how to prepare a vegan meat, maybe it wouldn't be hard at that point. And a lot of these things can be taught and learned if you have an open mind. But as Jeremy said, it really doesn't have to be that difficult.
Hmm. But what about mock duck? Is that made out of gluten?
I think it can be.
Because I really like mock duck. I mean, you're not saying, well, gee, I wish I could have the real duck, because it's kind of like its own thing.
Well, the other main form of mock meat, I think, is like made from soybeans or seitan or...
Oh, true. The other option.
A little can, yeah. Mock duck. Mock duck, I guess, is gluten. But,
I think that
but
one is.
Some gluten. Of the stuff you find in cans is actually made from a soy product. I'll defer to you on that, but that was my impression.
Yeah. Soy protein.
What's the scientific?
So this is where you get into isolates and concentrates in the plant protein space. So you have a soybean product that has been isolated to have a 90% protein content yield. So let's say for every 100 grams of this dry product, you have 90 grams of protein. When you look at chicken or meat on the same level on a weight basis, which is the true standard, maybe for like 100 grams of chicken meat, you have 20 to 30 grams of protein. So this is how plants, I mean, not theoretically, literally, have more protein than animal-based products. Hmm.
Well, MJ, okay. I'm wondering, if a musician goes to see the opera, they're not simply listening and engaged like everyone else, because they're kind of secondary judging, you know, all the other things that's going on. They can tell if they hit the wrong note or the tempo is wrong. When you're eating, do you ever get so engulfed, you just say, oh, this is so wonderful? And because a lot of people that say, oh, it's so wonderful, they're not giving the least amount of thought to the nutrition or to the scientific composition. How split apart is your brain? Can you really enjoy food?
I'm really glad I'm answering this question, not my family. It's a battle for me to find options in the grocery store and in a restaurant environment. And for that reason, I take it upon myself to create the products that I eat. And I wish more people were interested, and maybe they actually are, but it's just hard to find and know that demographic exists, are interested in eating like myself. But the standards that I adopt as a food scientist, and I would say as a food scientist just because I'm aware of the nutritional guidelines that are in place and why they're in place, I have a low sugar, gluten-free, plant-based diet. So finding options is as slim as you said. But when I enjoy something and it's able to hit on all those marks and it still tastes good, and I would say I'm pretty picky on what tastes good in my mind. I'll have an open mind, but there are bars out there that I've returned because I am so disappointed that they could even be sold on grocery shelves. Have you ever thought about that when you look at any product on the store and you're like, how did this make it past all these people?
And they do so well, too, in sales.
Yeah.
I know, like some bars, because they can be, I mean, I only eat them on the run or as a snack, but I'm kind of picky with bars, too.
Yeah.
Because some... like for me, even as much as I love eating meat and everything, I like to eat raw and vegan, or at least vegan for some weird reason. When I eat bars, maybe it's like the healthier.
It's so like a balance out. I mean,
some sort of balance.
Go to one extreme if you go to the other extreme afterwards.
Yeah. Has
any of you ever fasted?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's that like to love food but then avoid it?
It's hard.
So when I fast, what usually happens is, it's a result of my environment. So if I'm traveling for work and I cannot find any options, I could spend a lot of time being hangry, or I could say, this is me fasting.
So that's kind of a forced fast.
It's a forced fast, but it actually works out really well. I have to say, by having more than some limitations on what I eat, the inability to find options can create a lot of anxiety, which is kind of, it's a silly problem in a way, or at least it sounds like it on the surface. But before you can leave the house, if you're wondering, oh gosh, you know, I'm going to be hungry this afternoon and this evening, what am I going to eat? Where am I going to find it? You don't want to accept the standard that you're going to, in a way, feel like you're starving.
That's why it's like good to research before. I like anywhere I go, or whether I travel, I research. So I go, okay, there's options in case I don't want this, I have this.
Oh my gosh! It's like in the old
ancestral days when you went out, you had to hunt in order to eat. You have to hunt a restaurant or hunt a.
I feel like if I were
a protein
Kim.
Bar.
I feel like if I were Kim, I would never even search because you eat so many, like such a diversity of food. It doesn't seem like you have any real limitations. So, except based on great taste and great looks, I made her sound so shallow. No.
Because I'm looking at your tofu, honestly, like right here. It's not like necessarily the prettiest because, you know, it's kind of brown and everything, but it's still good.
Square.
Yeah. It's square, but I know I love it, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's good, but I don't know. Like when I take pictures of food, I would not want to take a picture of like this tofu bowl in like a dark setting.
Because some people are like, what is that? You know, it doesn't even look like it could be anything.
Well, arguably, you wouldn't want to take a picture in any dark setting, right?
Definitely, but some people do.
Okay.
And that's okay. But like for me, I'm more about good lighting.
Yeah. I want to ask you about food pictures, because understanding the appeal and how important that is to the consumer and to an Instagram feed. What about ugly food, and ugly food being food that would otherwise be a byproduct or a waste product, but able to be marketed in a way that consumers can still eat it, still delivers nutrition. It just doesn't look as nice.
Ooh, that's a tricky
Barnanas,
one.
Barnanas, I think, is the name of the brand.
Not the poster child
like
of
yeah.
beautiful food.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I probably wouldn't really post it. I would put my stories or and write about it, you know, my stories, but not for a permanent post. Because people might be turned off by it, honestly. They might look at it and go, oh, that doesn't look too good, even though it could be like the best tasting thing they've had in a while.
It has a good personality, but anyway, we're going to take another break here and try some different samples of the Vietnamese food that Kim Lee Curry brought to us from the Khi Viet restaurant in Northeast Minneapolis. We'll be right back after this.
Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back for our final segment here on Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. Meal of the Air is more like it. Eating some delicious Vietnamese food with our foodie guests, MJ Kinney, Kim Lee Curry, and Jeremy Eggers. Now, the cooking, I was, you know, once again, I'd like this prehistory topic, and it kind of amazed me to think that fire was invented like a million years ago, before Homo sapiens. It was a couple ladders, you know, a couple notches up the ladder of you know, human evolution. And what they're saying is that because they could cook food with that fire, it had actually accelerated the development of our brain, because you could ingest more calories. And they had, I saw a documentary where the woman said, well, see this bag of carrots? How long would it take you to eat those if you ate them raw? And then so she's eating them for like a couple hours. But if you cook them up, you could eat them in like 20 minutes. So there's a certain efficiency that came with food. Mm-hmm. So cooking is part of what makes us human. Mm-hmm. Do you cook? Are you, to what extent are you human, Jeremy?
About 50%. my wife does almost all the cooking. I cook when she's out of town, and then it's...
What do you like to cook?
Well, these days it's really, really basic. I'll doctor up some ramen, you know.
Okay, back when the days
omelets,
you cooked, when you did cook.
Oh, stir fries mostly, sort of basically Chinese stir fries.
I do stir fries too. I do plant-based stir fries.
Why did I not guess that?
Actually, Trader Joe's has a great product. It's a soy chorizo.
Oh, I've had that.
Yeah, have you?
It's good.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
So there was a vegan potluck over the weekend, this past weekend, that I went to, and it was really cool. I guess this is an event they hold once a year, and so many people came out, and there were like over 50-plus side dishes that people brought, just vegan products, right? And very creative ones, too. One of the ones I really enjoyed was like a spinach paneer, but instead of the paneer cubes, it was baked tofu, which I always thought was a great idea, but I'm too lazy to make myself sometimes. But I do the soy chorizo with corn and some green onions or anything else that adds like that texture and flavor. And then I just dump it on top of a bed of lettuce, and it's very flavorful and very easy. So the extent of my cooking is reheating the soy chorizo.
Okay. You do warming. I do warming.
I don't cook. Do warming. Yeah.
So Kim.
Yeah. I mainly eat out, honestly. If there's any cooking, it's heating up the food these days.
But you do some cooking.
I do. Not as much, though. Honestly, I don't cook that much. But when I do, I'll spend probably a good 3 to 4 hours in the kitchen, because I love cooking. I love prepping and I love making food, but I just don't have time these days.
Mm.
Otherwise, if I can, I would cook more often.
Mm. Do you enjoy your leftovers cold?
I do.
I do.
I do.
Yeah.
Like, I'll eat cold spaghetti. Yep. Because it's easy for me to take stuff out of the fridge, and maybe, like, there's a lazy part of me sometimes, like, okay, it takes forever to cook sometimes, you know, or to reheat the food. I'm like, I can't wait. So I'm like, I'll just take it out of the fridge and just start eating.
Jeremy, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. How do you feel
about
that?
You turned your head like, oh.
I know.
Pizza, especially. Cold pizza.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Pizza's great.
And otherwise, I had Thai leftovers this Before I came over, before I knew what a spread we were going to be having, I had some Thai with them. And those really have to be heated up too.
No, that's true. Like certain foods, I suppose, but like soups, you can't, unless it's a cold soup.
Oh, I could tell you a good example. Whenever there's coconut cream in anything, because when that gets cold, it solidifies. So unless you like icy little chunks of coconut, which maybe someone out there does.
That's true.
That's the one
thing
I have to.
Well, I eat Thanksgiving dinner in order to have leftovers.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to cook it and always cook a little extra. And then, warming it up. I think that's when I bought my microwave to be able to warm up a plate full of all those things. And you're right, the gravy turns into like a thick jello. And so it needs to be heated up in order to to spread around to the potatoes and the dressing and all those things.
Yeah, I just think there's something really unique about when you get food out and you have leftovers in the fridge and it's like this little treat to yourself, like you're so glad you just saved a little bit.
And I agree.
And then it tastes so good when it's even cold. And it
If you know, I mean, it's really good if it's cold to me. Mm-hmm. That's like a true test of good food. Mm-hmm. If it's cold. Like for me, I'll be like, sometimes I'll have like a midnight snack. I'm like, okay, what do I have? Wings. I'm like, I'll eat wings cold. Easily.
Well, chicken, that's famous for being good cold.
That's true.
Not
steak,
though.
Actually, steak, I've done it cold. It's not as good as chicken, but I mean, I'll still eat it cold if I have to. Mm.
Well, I tend to have to warm up a lot of things. But some things are better the second day anyway, like pizza, spaghetti. If you've made spaghetti, it kind of somehow marinates better over the next day or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more flavorful.
Yeah.
I think it also has something to do with, I don't know, I make food. I mean, I meal prep every Sunday, and it's sitting in my fridge cold all the time. But it's not the same feeling, and I think it's because somebody else prepared it for me. Maybe it's that I appreciate it a little bit more.
That it's ready for you.
It's ready for me. I didn't have to think about it. It's one less, a lot of less, fewer decisions that I have to make in preparing it. But it reminds me of like when I was a kid, how I rely on my mom to like make a lot of my food for me because it just tasted better when she did it. Like her omelets are always going to be my omelets, no matter how hard I try. And I have tried.
You've turned into your mother's omelet.
Yeah, my mom. Mm-hmm. Well, no, I aspire to make my mom's omelets.
Oh, you're never as good?
Never as good. No. She's had a lot of practice. And same for things like there was a part of my life when I had to eat liver and I really didn't enjoy it, but it was for purposes of my thyroid. And that's something that if I tried to, and I did try to make it myself, did not taste good and I wouldn't finish it. But if my mom ate it, it was very different. Mm. So food, alongside like all the science, in order for it to be effective in one's life, there's like this comfort food nostalgia connected to it. And then there's this ability to compartmentalize the food because maybe, especially as it pertains to animal welfare, you don't have to think about it as much when somebody's making it for you.
Well, animal welfare, that brings up the whole ethical part of what you eat. And I assume that's why a lot of people are vegetarians now or vegan, just to not hurt plants and something about saving the world. What's the latest ethical argument, Jeremy?
Well, I think it's shifted a little bit away from do animals have a right to live to do animals have a right not to suffer. And that's really focused attention on the CAFOs, the factory farms where animals are treated pretty miserably. I mean, you can probably find a ag industry spokesperson who'll come on and defend what they do.
they're happy to be in that.
But
little
it is pretty miserable. Yeah.
So animal suffering, and then what part of the argument, too, is just the use of the earth and its resources, right?
Well, I mean, there are, I think, there's the issue of how farm labor is treated, which is also pretty miserable.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
The people who process meat, and the big issue, then there's also the environmental issues, that it's really destructive to the planet, that meat production accounts for a big chunk of CO2 production, I understand it. So you may know more about this than I do. So.
I read this fantastic book recently called Clean Meat. It's by Paul Shapiro. And he really talks about this in a way that's so open-minded and knowledgeable. It's really the download knowledge drop of the landscape of meat. So it's going back to what is meat and looking at all the options that are available. So you have your traditional meat that's maybe in no way farmed or raised in a traditional fashion in today's world. Concentrated animal feeding operations or CAFOs, factory farming being behind that.
CAFO.
But, you have your traditional animal-based meats, you have your plant-based meats, You have meat analogs, which are a hybrid of plant-based and traditional animal meat. And then you have this new field that, you know, they've been working on for some time. Hopefully they're going to have some real products out commercially here soon. But clean meat is when you're able to match animal-based products, you know, molecules and proteins, everything on a nutritional level. It's going to taste like animal meat, but it's going to be grown in a controlled environment, which starts in a lab, but eventually, like anything that goes commercial, would be manufactured in a manufacturing facility like a lot of other food
products. Is it the DNA from a meat, or is it just... Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what I was wondering.
So, yeah, it's...
They take a sample and grow it. They clone
right.
it, clone
that's
it
right.
and grow it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's taking the tissue from an animal, which could be through a biopsy or a swab, like cells that are on your skin or in your hair or in feathers.
I can't remember the name of the guy who did it, but there was a very highly publicized tasting a couple of years ago of the first sort of open tasting of this kind of test tube meat, and it cost, I think they figured out, it worked out to about $250,000 for a hamburger.
Yeah.
$300,000
actually.
They nailed the red part of the meat, but what was missing, I guess, was the fat, or a simulation of the fat, which is what, and fat's what makes food taste good.
Right, they need to marbleize that fake meat.
That they're still working on, I think.
Yeah, and what you mentioned is so interesting, because what if you could control how much fat is in that product, which you can. You can control how much fat, how much protein. You can create hybrids of animals. Let's say you want chicken and duck together, you know?
Surf and turf.
What if you want turkey and duck and have like the real turducken, right? Like, and it's grown in a controlled environment that causes none of the negative effects that we know of traditional animal meat, and it's going to taste the same and deliver the same nutrition.
Now, what they were producing was mm-hmm. hamburger, which is, you know, sort of finely ground. Can they produce, you know, chunks of muscle too, or is
absolutely they can. So, they did a ground animal meat product, and I don't know all the science that's wrapped up in this. The Good Food Institute is a nonprofit organization that is doing a tremendous job at communicating the science and research on this topic. But essentially, you have cells derived from an animal. They're grown in a controlled environment, which could include some physiologic components like exercise, which make the muscle as tough as, you know, need it to be.
I have to ask you, I mean, Jeremy, if you're saying that the argument against eating animals that suffer, what about eating meat that never has a chance to have any fun at all? I mean, it's they're in this test tube its whole life. I think that's kind of a deprivation.
Well, there is no connection to a brain. It's
see, that's another reason that it's...
Well,
so would that be considered a vegetarian meat still, even though they use tissues?
You know, like, yeah.
I'm curious about how people would perceive that as. Like, can you say that's actually vegetarian or vegan, or is it still considered like real meat?
Right. So this is uncharted territory, and we're going to have to make the rules as we go. But what I believe to be true is, first of all, there isn't a standard of identity for or a standard or definition recognized by the FDA for vegan, which in my opinion is a problem, because if you really are out to do the most good and not involve any animals in the process, you should know that your product is definitely vegan. But if it is derived from an animal and it requires a biopsy, it depends on, I mean, I guess how extreme or where on that spectrum you lie as far as a vegan.
What about that very first part of DNA that they got? That's from the animal, right, originally?
Mm-hmm. That's from the animal originally.
So
that's what I'm wondering, yeah.
It might matter to some people whether the animal had to be killed in order to harvest that cluster of cells, or whether they were just...
Took it off an elbow.
Well, they took it off while they're still grazing.
Yeah, so...
It's like those crab claws down in Florida where they can harvest a claw... And stone crabs, they can harvest a claw and it'll grow back.
Oh, and my goodness.
I did not know that.
Well, but then they got greedy and discovered if they harvested both claws at the same time, they'd make twice the money. But, the poor crab was defenseless without any claws.
Oh, my goodness.
The claws, claws.
Google that story later. Well, a video you should check out on YouTube is just type in Ian the Chicken, and this is by the team at Just. You know, Ian is a chicken, and he is walking around happily in a yard while they're eating chicken nuggets that are derived from a tissue sample of Ian, the chicken. Yeah. So you don't have to kill an animal in order to extract.
So Ian lives.
Yeah, Ian lives. Yeah.
Okay, how about this? How about, is there such thing as or in the talks of 3D printing of food?
Yeah, absolutely. Modern Meadow is a company that, to my knowledge, really spearheaded
this. 3D printing of food.
Oh, so cool.
So that 3D, you have to spray out something. So they're spraying out some sort of...
I'm not sure product. Exactly what's in there. It would be cells, of course, cells that are fed a certain diet, being, you know, sugar, peptides, other micro and macronutrients. But yeah, they'd be formed into a layer. But Modern Meadow is taking an approach that wouldn't be utilized in the food industry, but in clothing. They're 3D printing leather. And I think that's really cool.
I read about that. Yeah. I thought that was really cool.
Does that, you know, you're like, let me see if she...
No. I knew about that. But just like for food, I was curious about food because I figured there could be some 3D printing on food, but I didn't know. And I'm like, that could save the world.
Yeah, well, that and blockchain is kind of like all the talk on the technology of tomorrow in the food industry.
No, they're not going to blockchain food.
Oh, well, you would hope that they would blockchain food because with blockchain technology, you'd be able to understand all the parties that your food went through in order to make it to its end destination. So if anything went wrong, like let's say there's a recall, you have to go back into the chain and understand where it went wrong. And now you have a party that's liable that otherwise would never take the blame for or have really any accountability over the process.
Like I heard of a guy who retired from 3M that tracked food and found out that the hamburger, the ground beef in Ireland was actually horse from Poland.
Right.
So you can check the DNA. So that's what the blockchaining thing would be to keep some sort of a record of things?
Yeah, blockchain would be a record of things. And and also for the consumer who would be benefiting from blockchain, hopefully it would mean fewer food recalls, or if there was a recall, faster turnaround on fixing it. It could also mean that when you scan a QR code that's on a future product, you know where it was grown and where it was manufactured.
Boy, I wonder what they can do then next to humans so that we wouldn't have to eat.
Right. So you could...
Are they working on that?
Does that actually appeal to you?
For me, cooking and eating is a pleasure. So that's why the nutrition is like, you know, an afterthought.
So intravenous feeding.
Mm. Ooh.
Yeah.
But that's not good either.
I mean, I haven't done it. I'm not interested in that. But I mean,
do people do that? Is that the next thing?
In hospitals.
Oh, what's it called? Soylent.
Oh, Soylent.
Yeah, okay. Soylent. Yeah. You're right.
Soylent Green?
Well, it's named after Soylent Green, but it's this powder, I think it is, that you can mix up 3 times a day. It's kind of for techno geeks who only want to code and sleep or don't even sleep.
So
but
food is like, a bother.
It's a nutritionally balanced thing. Tastes like mud, apparently. I don't know, but
I don't know what it tastes like.
It's Soylent. It's being marketed. I think there's some side effects, but...
I would think so.
I would hope. I think it's a side effect to take it.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to be in a small room with
it. I know the story of Soylent a little bit.
Oh, and I'm sorry.
I think that there may have been an allergen or an allergic reaction tied to Soylent, which would be, of course, unique to the individual. Wouldn't mean that Soylent is a bad product because somebody had an allergic reaction to it. Unless, of course, they didn't put that allergen or disclose one of the top 8 on their food packaging. But to my understanding, it's a meal replacement. And it's a it's a meal replacement that's really designed so that all of your nutritional needs are met when you drink this product. And yes, definitely for the individual who's working and doing things that are, they're totally engulfed in it and they just got to get something in their stomach.
I was going to say a mad scientist, but you're a scientist, so I don't want to offend you. Okay, we're almost out of time. What's the next good meal you're looking forward to? Start with you, MJ.
Well, today's a pretty action-packed day for me, so I have 3 protein bars in my bag. That's not the best meal that I look forward to. This is honestly the one I look forward to.
Okay,
right
the
now.
One we're having now.
Yeah, the one we're having now.
Vegan
this
Vietnamese.
This tofu and rice noodles.
Okay. Kim Lee.
I'm looking forward to trying out I'm previewing a new menu for D'Amico tonight, so I'm excited to try that.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Good. And Jeremy?
My wife and my niece and I are all going out. It's a special occasion, so we're going to Tenant, which is a little restaurant in South Minneapolis that has, I think, it seats about 20 people, and the chefs bring each course out. It's like 5 courses, I think, and it's really good food.
Hmm. Sounds good. Well, I'm headed off to we're having our Deconstructing Minnesota Nice event tonight at the Norway House, and they're having Nordic waffles.
Oh, boy.
So we're going to try those. Mm-hmm. Well, it's been fun eating with you, chatting with you, chewing the fat, I guess is what they would call it. thank you so much, Kim Lee Curry, MJ Kinney, and Jeremy Eggers. I'm Steve LeBeau, and we also had Dan Cook as our engineer. This is a co-production with WCCO Radio. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Synapse. Think Tank of the Air. I'm Leo Espinosa.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
We the people of the ballpark are all in on baseball. We deserve dingers and dogs, sunshine and a beat, a place to take it all in and let it all out. Baseball for the people. Baseball is something else. Visit MLB.com/tickets and spend this summer with us. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
When equipment breaks down and operations come to a halt, every single second counts. So why is your maintenance team spending 60% of their time doing anything but turning wrenches? Maintain X is the AI-powered maintenance and asset management system that helps your team get back to actually fixing breakdowns. No more searching for manuals. No more hunting down parts. No more drowning in paperwork. With Maintain X, your team can access manuals from anywhere, create new procedures in minutes, and turn voice notes into clear and complete work order feedback. What used to take hours now only takes minutes. Keep your operations moving and your wrenches turning. Join over 13,000 maintenance teams that are already fixing more and filing less. Try MaintainX for free today. Go to MaintainX.com/AI. That's maintain in the letter X.com/AI.
Hi, I'm Kirk Cameron. Is health insurance eating up your budget for 2026? If you're looking for ways to better steward your finances, consider this. Christian Healthcare Ministries is a health insurance alternative at half the cost. As a ministry, CHM allows you to share the burden of medical bills with other believers. Join CHM today by visiting chministries.org/solution. That's chministries.org/solution.
Nerds.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Personal finance can feel like a pop quiz you didn't study for. This podcast is your study guide. On NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast, you'll hear from trusted journalists who explain the why behind major financial decisions. You'll get research-backed insights and clear pros and cons, whether you're planning a big purchase or just want to grow your wealth. Make your next financial move with confidence. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast on your favorite podcast app.